We come to the conclusion of our series of lessons from the Ten Commandments. The Scripture includes the Old Testament for our learning, among other things, and we're learning some lessons from just one very small portion or segment of the Old Testament, the so-called Ten Commandments that were given by God to Moses to pass on to the Israelites as they were departing Egyptian slavery and moving towards the so-called promised land of Canaan. And these Ten Commandments, I have no idea, other than speculative, of course, as to why they were singled out for putting in stone when there were hundreds of others that could have been chosen. But God chose these ten to put on stone tablets and later to be preserved in the Ark of the Covenant for centuries. And I just wonder what we can learn from observing these ten that he selected. And I've tried to do my best over the last few Sunday evenings that we've been talking about it. And we'll wrap it up tonight. Appreciate the good compliments along the way about the lessons. One of my favorites, and I don't mean to put yours down if the one I'm about to say is not yours. But Nicole, just before she left to go home to Ashland, wanted to make sure she got the outline that she was going to be missing. And I thought that was sweet. That's nice that she wanted to make sure she didn't miss anything just by going home from school. But the rest of you who've also spoken about them in favor, I appreciate it very much. I'm not going to review the other eight for the sake of time. And I know you will not at all be disappointed in that. As we get near the end, it gets longer, the review. But we'll go right to number nine. Commandment number 9, and this is in Deuteronomy 5 that we've been looking at the Ten Commandment relisting, actually, as Chad alluded to at the table. Deuteronomy, the second giving of the law, we have a second rendering, if you will, of the Ten Commandments, a mention or listing, and that's the list I've been using to quote from as we go through these Ten Commandments two at a time. And we've got two more, and we're through, 9 and 10. I will say one thing that just has popped in my head that I've said a couple times before, but I think I want to mention it this one last time. And that is that the commandments start off with the first four having to do vertically with your relationship with God. And I think there is some credence to that. There is something of consideration that we ought to give to that. First and foremost, your vertical fellowship and relationship with God has to be as it ought to be, and the first four commandments reflect that. Then we go to the relationships that we have with others, which also are commandments, not suggestions. They are commandments of God, and the last six deal with how we deal with socially others in this world, and that's of importance to God also, and we're looking at the last two. Deuteronomy 5:20. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Against your neighbor. False witness, of course, the word false right away you recognize as having something to do with lying, something that's not true. You will not say those things untrue about your neighbor, lying about them, whether that be informal testimony in court or whether that be just informally done. It amounts to no lying about your neighbor. And that is something that I will command, God says, that you not do. Look at Exodus 23, and my notes are very similar to yours, so you can stay ahead of me in going to places, scriptures that we'll be noting and referencing. And here's the first one. Exodus chapter 23, verses 1 and 2. False accusations, charges brought, trumped up, if you will, were forbidden and commanded against by God. You shall not circulate a false report. That might be gossiping. You shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You will not do that. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. I will have none of that, God seems to be saying. So when it comes to false witness, be understanding that it's not just simply in court. When you hear the word witness or testimony, you may think formally that whenever I go to court, I can't lie about people. Believe me, it starts before that. And that would be included, but not the limitation of it. It would include, though, things like perversion of justice or forswearing yourself. We even in our civil courts, of course, have provisions for a person, you know, who forswears himself or who does under oath lie and such like. Ruining reputations, though, would be included. Slandering someone, defamation of character would be that which would be prohibited. Go to Deuteronomy 19 next. In Deuteronomy chapter 19, look at verses 16 through 21. Deuteronomy 19 and beginning in verse number 16, and we'll read through the end, I believe it is. If a false witness arises, if a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priest, and the judges who serve in those days. And the judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness, who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you by doing that, is the idea. And those who remain shall hear in fear when they see that happening. And hereafter, they shall not again commit such evil among you. Hopefully, when they see this happening, they'll be slow to do that in the future. And how shall we react to such as that? Well, 21, your eye shall not pity it either. I will not have you feeling sorry for them. And then he says, it will be this, life for life. If the man brought a charge that would be worthy of punishment by death, meaning a capital crime, and it's found to be a false charge, he will be put to death for having lied about it. For him having said something in an accusatory fashion that was inquired into and found to be a trumped up charge, and the charge would have been worthy of life being given, taken, then he will have to pay for that himself, having lied about it. Serious! When you then witness this, or others standing about, hear of it, they'll be slow next time to do such as that, hopefully. They're not going to be quick to bring a charge against someone that can be unsubstantiated, that cannot have two or more witnesses, that cannot be proven without doubt to be true, because why not? Because if it's found out that you're false, you will have to pay the penalty that would have been due them. Life for life, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, and even exchange, if you will, if I understand that correctly. In Proverbs chapter 6, it's regarded as abominable. You have to be careful how you say that. Abominable. It's an abomination. It's detestable is the idea. It's despicable. One of my children asked me last night, I think it was, what does despicable mean? Well, this is it. It's an abomination. It's despicable. It's disgusting. Look at Proverbs chapter 6 then, verses 16 through 19. Proverbs chapter 6 and beginning in verse number 16. There's a list of six, in fact, seven things that are abominable to the Lord, that are detestable to Him, repulsive, if you will. He hates them, and what are they? 17, a proud look. Don't even look haughty. A lying tongue, there it is. Hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness, there it is again, who speaks lies. And here it is again, and one who sows discord among brethren, connected with lying about it, bringing up charges to cause discord. Well, you've got two, yea, three, that are really in commandment number 9, this idea of bringing false witness. Thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. I hate it. It's abominable. And he mentions it at least in so many words, two or three times in that list of six, yea, seven of Proverbs 6. Almost half of the six or seven, if you will, have to do with this thing right here. Stop lying about other people. Stop saying things that are not true about them. And gossip and slander and defamation of character and ruining reputations. I hate that kind of thing. And chapter 12, same book, chapter 12, verse 17. chapter 12 and 17 reads this way, "He who speaks truth declares righteousness, but a false witness deceit. There is one who speaks like the piercings of a sword, but the tongue of the wise promotes health. The truthful lip shall be established forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. Deceit is in the heart of those who devise evil, but counselors of peace have joy." Through 22, I said, yes. 21, "No grave trouble will overtake the righteous, but the wicked shall be filled with evil. Lying lips," "lying lips are" what? "An abomination to the Lord, but those who deal truthfully are His delight." Brethren, friends, we have to be careful that we are not bearers of false witness. It's an abomination to the Lord. Does the New Testament teach such as this? You know that it does, but let me show you a few verses just to take away any doubt, should there be any. Go to and there's more than these. I've just chosen four or five here. Look at Acts chapter 24. Acts chapter 24, in speaking about Paul when in prison and the charges brought against him. Look at what's said about it in chapter 24 of Acts and verse number 10. "Then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him to speak, answered, 'Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself. Because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship, and neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city.'" Now look at 13, "Nor can they prove the things of which they now accuse me." They're accusing me of things falsely. They can't prove any of it. But the accusations were still flying nonetheless. Let me show you another one. 25 and verse 7. 25 verse 7. "When he had come, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about and laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove." Which they could not prove. We need to be careful. We're not in that camp, making accusations of others we cannot prove. Turn to Ephesians 4 and 25. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25. "Therefore, putting away lying, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another." Now, why would you, as a member of the body, want to work against another member of the body? We're all members of one another, so let's not lie any longer or any more with one another. 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy chapter 1, beginning in verse 8, and we'll go through verse 11. Speaking of the law, it says, "But we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully." I paraphrase there a little bit. "Knowing this, that the law is not made for a righteous person, but for the lawless and insubordinate, for the ungodly and for sinners, for the unholy and profane, for murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers, for manslayers, for fornicators, for sodomites, for kidnappers, for liars." Ooh, that is a terrible list. And then included is perjurers. Perjurers. Those who perjured themselves lying under oath, if you will. And if there's any other thing that is contrary to sound doctrine according to the glorious gospel. Is perjuring yourself contrary to the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ? Of course it is. It's not just an Old Testament thing. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 3, 2 Timothy 3 and verse number 3, well, that's a list, so let me back up a little bit. Verse 1, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good," and the list goes on. Slandering, speaking against. In Revelation 22:15, look on your own, the lake of fire is reserved for those that lie. All right, what are some lessons in it for us? If you haven't already picked out a few for yourself, let me share two or three with you. One, where does all this come from? Where does this business of lying against, slandering, defaming character, bringing discord among brethren through the accusations that you make and so forth, forswearing yourself, bearing false witness? Well, in Matthew chapter 15, 19, you'll find the answer. Matthew chapter 15 and verse 19. Where does this all come from? Or we could word this differently. Why is it such a big deal? Well, what does God seem to be? Why would he even make it one of the ten? Make it commandment number 99. Does it really need part of the ten? Be part of the ten. Here's, I think, a clue, if you will, as to why it's such a big deal. Verse 19, for out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness. False witness. It's a demonstration of an evil heart that does such as that. And so, that's ultimately where we're headed. We're headed into a territory of a heart issue we must address. Or, let me put it just as plainly or as simply as I can, why do you want to do this? That's what we're talking about when we talk about the heart. When you speak false witness against another, why do you want to? Why does your heart want to do that? It's out of the evil heart that such comes. Next, it's dangerous to speak against another. You want to be very sure of the accuracy of your information. I have a gossip lesson coming up in a few weeks, so let me not steal my own thunder later. But why do we gossip is the name of a lesson that I'll be preaching not too far in the future. So you want to make sure you check your motives, even if what you're saying is true. In the end, do not bear false witness. Okay, let's go back one more time and we're through. Deuteronomy 5:21 and we'll wrap it up. The last of the ten, as recorded in Deuteronomy 5, is verse 21. I'll give you a second to find it again if you've lost it. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 21, the last one is, you shall not covet. But it's more expanded on in this way, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. And you shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Whatever he's got, you will not desire it. You will not covet it. You know, it's a mistake to think that the Old Testament only dealt with externals. And it's not until we come to Jesus and the New Covenant do we get to the heart. This is dealing with desires. You shall not desire certain things. Don't make the mistake of thinking the Old Testament dealt with only the outer man. The inner man was something reserved for the New Testament era. It wasn't. When Jesus, or when God says to Moses, write this down, or actually he wrote it himself with his finger on the Ten Commandments, you shall not, or thou shalt not covet, you will not have within yourself desires. I command it. You will not desire things of your neighbors. God expected them to not long for that which was another's. They must learn to control their wants. There's a popular song that goes something like this. Being happy and being satisfied and content and all of that is not having everything that you want, but wanting everything you've got. You know, we've got to control our wants. I'm trying to put this just as simply as I can. Thou shalt not covet sounds, you know, really, you know, formal. Let's get it right down to the level that we live on. You will not want certain things. I command it. You shall not desire it. For instance, I will not want my neighbor's wife. Adultery, we've already heard about, have we not? If you were here on Sunday nights prior, you make a mistake if you think, when Jesus says, you've heard of old, thou shalt not commit adultery, let me introduce something new to you. You will not lust after her in your heart. That's old. Thou shalt not desire your neighbor's wife was part of the Ten Commandments. They, in Jesus' day, may have changed it somewhat to be just a physical prohibition. It had always also been a longing disposition of mind that was prohibited as well. When Jesus says, if a man looks upon a woman to lust after her in his heart, that's not altogether new. It may be in some respects to the people that first heard it in Jesus' day, but that was incorporated into the 10th commandment, you will not desire your neighbor's wife. No longing for her. That's forbidden. Job understood it. Go to Job 31. And Job lived before the Ten Commandments, from what I understand, from those who study the age of books of the Bible. Some think Job was a contemporary of Abraham. And of course, Abraham lived 1,000 years before Moses, so we're dealing with pre-Ten Commandment era times. Job understood the 10th commandment before it was ever put in stone. In Deuteronomy, what did I say? 31? Yes. Job 31. He understood it. Look at verse 1. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? I have to watch my eyes and their longing. Look at verse 9. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I've lurked at my neighbor's door, implied is to have something to do with her, then let my wife grind for another, and let others bow down over her. For that would be wickedness. Yes, it would be iniquity deserving of judgment. For that would be fire that consumes to destruction, a fire, and would root out all my increase. Job knew about it 1,000 years before the Ten Commandments. You don't long for your neighbor and your neighbor's wife. Peter also understood it well in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 14. In 2 Peter 2, he understood it, and he describes it in this way. The control, if you will, of your desires for others, and in this case we're talking about desires for your neighbor's wife. In 2 Peter 2, in describing some that were, in verse 12, described as natural brute beasts in their behavior, look at how he describes them in 14. They have eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin. They have eyes full of it. It's not so much whether they're engaged in it physically. Their eyes are full of adultery and they can't stop it. They're addicted. They can't look upon a woman without having lustful thoughts. The New Testament in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 11, makes it plain. This is a New Testament commandment just as much as it was an Old Testament commandment. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse number 11, but now I've written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral or covetous. Or an idolater, or a reviler, or a drunkard. Yeah, all of that we have no problem with. It's that second one that we need to think about. Or covetous. Or he who has desires. That's what we're talking about. Covetousness. An inordinate desire or want for things. Does a brother have covetous eyes or eyes full of adultery? Or it may not be a woman, it may be covetousness of another's property. Don't, he says, eat with them. Verse 11. Don't eat with a brother who can't control his desires for those things of another. All right, let's wrap it up here. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verses 6 through 10. Got a couple verses for you as we finish up. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6 through 10. I've got to start working on this contentment business. I've got to learn to be content. You might say, what's that have to do with covetousness? May I be so simple as to say it's the opposite of what we've got a problem with if we're covetous. Covetousness is discontentment. Look at it this way. In verse 6, 1 Timothy chapter 6. Now godliness with contentment, or may I reword it, godliness in the absence of covetousness, is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it's certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these, we should be content. That's not the way it reads. We shall be content with that. In my prayers, and I often pray this exact thing, Lord, help me to have contentment with having just food and raiment, food and clothes. Not that I oughta, pardon the bad grammar, but that I must have contentment with those things. Help me to learn such. Verse 10, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. May I say, stopping right there to just give a little commentary, I skip verse 9. Those who desire to be rich, verse 9. Desire, that's covetousness. They who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful desires or lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money, desire again, The love of it is a root of all kinds of evil. And you can read the rest if you wish. Look at that. The desire, the love of the money, and the desires and lusts that are opposite of the contentment. I've got to learn contentment and learn it in a hurry, lest I be everywhere I turn, be found to be guilty of covetousness. In Ephesians 5:5, it is indicated to be idolatry. Covetousness is idolatry. Just as I did with the commandment number 9, and I said, well, really, what's so bad about it? What's so bad about bearing false witnesses? It comes from an evil heart. And I've got some heart problems if I'm bearing false witness. It's not just right here that it begins and ends. It's in here that this is showing itself to be one who bears false witness. I've got heart issues. Bearing false witness proceeds from an evil heart. Now let's go to this one. What's so wrong about having desires that are just a little bit over the top and covetous and lustful and so forth? Well, the big problem is that it invalidates my religion, because it's called idolatry. It's misplaced godship. And so that's what makes it so awfully bad. It's not a slap on the wrist. Well, I'll try to do better in the future. It's invalidating somewhat our religion. It is equated with being worshiping of a false god. Idolatry is covetousness in Ephesians 5:5. So guard your heart. Guard your heart, for out of it come the issues of life. That's where the real you is. It shows itself through things like false witness, bearing false witness, or covetousness, having eyes full of adultery. Those are just outer demonstrations of the heart problems from where come these issues of life that are corrupt. The commandments show us where, though, we can begin to work from the outside in, trying to change our hearts that would produce such outer problems as this.